Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The top story this week was the massacre in Afghanistan. On Sunday morning, an unnamed American soldier in Kandahar left his base, entered the homes of three families, and allegedly murdered 16 Afghans, including 9 children. All we know at this point is coming directly from the U.S. military. The 38-year-old soldier is reportedly en route to a detention facility in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The soldier's family has hired John Henry Brown to represent him. This is the lawyer who represented serial killer Ted Bundy. As Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting points out, most of the articles from national outlets focused on the public relations problem this latest atrocity is causing the United States. The headline on the front page of USA Today: Killings Threaten Afghan Mission. An Associated Press analysis called it, quote, the latest American public relations disaster in Afghanistan. The Washington Post reported that, quote, the killing Sunday threatened to spark a new crisis in the strained relationship between the U.S. and Afghanistan. Now, while those statements are obviously true, where is the analysis? This is just the latest incident in a long line of atrocities. On February 8th, NATO's International Security Assistance Force admitted that several children died during a bombing raid in the northeast Kapisa province. Afghan officials said a school was attacked by a NATO helicopter. Several children were killed and 9 were injured. And then in January, we saw videos shot by American soldiers showing 4 Marines urinating on the corpses of suspected members of the Taliban, whom they had killed. But where are the questions about why the U.S., with the most powerful military in the world, is still in a country where over half the population lives in poverty? A recent National Public Radio headline, killing a blow to U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. But what is the strategy, and who is asking this very important question? Today, we're joined by Paul McGow, chief foreign correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald, author of Infernal Triangle, Conflict in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Levant, eyewitness accounts from the September 11th decade. Paul has reported from the Middle East for more than 2 decades. Hi, Paul. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Great. It's nice to have you. And later in the show, we'll be joined by independent journalist Anna Bodkin, who has done extensive reporting from Afghanistan. So, Paul, as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
One of the things that struck me, and it was on the Afghanistan piece, because even though I wasn't in Afghanistan, I was working on the story from Washington here. I was very struck by, and what he did was he informed my approach to the story this week by the column by Dana Milbank in the Washington Post on Tuesday, where he was at the White House in the Rose Garden on Monday morning for the Obama, the knee-jerk response to the crisis. We will stay the course. We will stick to our program and the rest of it. Mm. Milbank did that nobody else at the press conference did, was to get into his car and drive over the bridge, over the Potomac River, to Arlington, to the cemetery where the young men who die in this war are buried. And he reported from amongst the gravestones in Section 60, and in particular focused on one young soldier who, 23 years old, died in Afghanistan, obviously had a sense that he would die and left a letter to be read in case of his death. And it was a fascinating letter because it talked about his young soldierly reason for why he was in Afghanistan, which was poignant and at the same time so quite removed from the reality of Afghanistan, because he was talking about his life, the value of his own life. It would be worth something if one young child was saved in Afghanistan, who would change the world?
So he was basically trying to show the human side of this, and that's often what's missing in most of the media coverage.
Yes, yes. And what I did was I then used that letter. He drew my attention to that letter. I then used that letter to try and craft a piece around the expectations of the father of the eight children who were murdered.
Mm. And how are you working on that piece? What have you found so far?
Well, I mean, it's the New York Times were there on the ground. They did a very good piece on the farmer, Abdul Samad, coming home. He'd been away for the weekend, coming back to his home and finding his wife and eight of his nine children massacred.
Mm.
But, you know, if you spend time on the ground in Afghanistan, you know that a typical village farmer has no such expectation of his children as the 23-year-old soldier who wrote his letter before he died. The farmers don't have any expectation that their children will change the world. That's not what they expect in life. If they're lucky, their children might go to school. The parents aren't fussed about them going to school more often than not. They're more interested in them working in the fields. If they can get from their home to their fields, from their fields to the market, and back on the weekly cycle and on the harvest cycle, the farming cycle, and get to the mosque, their life is complete.
It's interesting that you bring this up, because we were supposed to be joined by Jeremy Kelly with the Times of London, but he was called to a military base in Afghanistan, so he can't join us today, but maybe next week. But he has a piece called Afghan Father's Plea for Vengeance, Let Him Burn. And I'll just read the two first graphs. The father of eight children who were murdered by an American soldier in southern Afghanistan wants the killer to be tried in public and then burnt. Mohammad Wazir Arga, 35, said he would join the Taliban to take revenge on U.S. forces in Afghanistan if he failed to win justice for the slaughter of almost his entire family on Sunday. At the time of his killings, he had taken his four-year-old son, Habib Shah, to visit relatives. So Jeremy was going to join us to talk about this, but he had to go to a military base. What are your thoughts on this, Paul? Al Jazeera English is reporting that the Afghan chief of staff in this village said a delegation that traveled to Kandahar to speak with the American soldier suspected in the killing of these civilians was ignored by American officials. So the Afghans were ignored by the Americans. He said the delegation tried to speak to the gunman, but were told he had exercised his right to silence under U.S. law. And shortly after that, the general said he had been alerted that the staff sergeant had been transferred to a base in Kuwait without telling the Afghans about this.
Yes, this is the whole thing where constantly we've had it throughout the years in Iraq, and we have it again throughout the years in Afghanistan. The collision of cultural sense and sensibility of how things should be handled. The Afghans are used to either no justice at all, or a shot in the head justice, or a sort of instant ne'er-do-well type of justice, which they get from the Taliban-appointed courts. So when they are told that, look, we're investigating this and it could take months or maybe even a year before we can take this man to trial, they immediately suspect that he is getting off, that he's getting an easy run, that he's been airlifted out of the country, he's going home, he's going away, and there will be no justice. So that is something that is going to be stoked. Karzai came out this morning complaining about the refusal of the Americans to cooperate with an Afghan investigation. We all know full well that there's no way the Americans will cooperate with an Afghan investigation, and they'll do it themselves, and they'll insist on doing it themselves, and they will suffer from doing that because they will look bad in the eyes of Afghans.
So how do you report on a story like this? Because all of the information that we're getting about this 38-year-old soldier who reportedly spent three tours in Iraq, and this was his first tour in Afghanistan, so four altogether, all of this information is directly coming from the U.S. military. So how do you report on the details involved in who this soldier was and what his background really is?
Well, we're limited at the moment, but what is fascinating is that he comes from the Joint Base Lewis-McChord near Tacoma in Washington State, because that has a particularly bad record in terms of the conduct of servicemen who've come out of there. But more importantly, and again, I was struck by the comment by the leader of the American forces, or the commander of the American forces in Afghanistan this week, when he said, we will hold this individual fully accountable. Now, if you look at the bits and pieces of information that are already in the public domain, this already looks like a case that is more than about a single individual. Yes, as best we know, an individual went out with his gun and shot 16 people. But he comes from a base where we know that records were doctored, we know that records were manipulated to make hundreds of servicemen seem eligible for service when apparently they were not, because they were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. We know that this man has a record of injury and exposure to the ugliness, the brutality of war that makes it questionable. We've already got his lawyer saying that he was pleading not to be sent to Afghanistan when he was deemed fit to go to Afghanistan. This could very well become a window into how the war machine sends men back to war when it ought not to.
We have a question from a listener who says, why don't we ever hear about the people who were killed? And again, going back to the piece by Jeremy Kelly with the Times of London, he says that the man lost four of his sons and four of his daughters. He said they were aged between 2 and 12. Some had been shot in the forehead. His younger brother, also named Akhtar Muhammad, and three women, his wife, his mother, and Akhtar Muhammad's wife, were also killed. So the majority of these people were in one family.
Yes, they were. There was nine of them, and nine were directly related to Abdul Samad, the farmer, and then two were from his extended family. So that's 11 out of the 16 were effectively of the one clan. Now, you have to... It's difficult working on the ground in Afghanistan. Mm. But having said that, the Jeremy was out there on the ground. He got the interviews. The New York Times had people on the ground. They got the interviews. They were there when Abdul Samad took the call from Hamid Karzai, and where he uttered that incredible line, either finish us off or get rid of the Americans.
We're speaking with Paul McGow, Chief Foreign Correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald, and we're talking about media coverage of the massacres in Afghanistan that took place on Sunday, and this is dominating headlines this week. What really strikes you about what you've seen? What questions do you think reporters should be asking at this point? I mean, this is clearly, obviously, not the first atrocity, and something that really struck me is I felt like some of the reports and the questions I heard this week, I heard a few years ago. It could have been 2007, 2010. It just sounded very similar. And I wonder who's connecting the dots here. I also thought about Winter Soldier, because so many soldiers who came back from Iraq talked about what really goes on the ground. So what did you make of the coverage? What do you want from coverage when something like this happens? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And also, if there was another story you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. So what about how the military and the government are kind of shaping the story about this soldier? Because now we're hearing that this was a decorated soldier, deeply impacted by seeing his friend's leg being blown up, and did this for revenge. The New York Times said that the staff sergeant suspected of killing Afghan villagers had been drinking alcohol, a violation of military rules, and suffering from the stress related to his fourth tour and tensions with his wife about the deployments on the night of the massacre. This is according to a senior American official. So when you get information like this, how should the media report this? And what do you think of the frame that they're using?
Well, you have to go with the sources that are available. You have to work as wide a field of sources and voices that you can, and then you have to assess what you get. I mean, the problems that I have with 24/7 cable news these days is that you get the sense that the mic is open too often, and stuff just pours down without being edited. And by edited, I mean being evaluated and an attempt to make sense of it. So you can't sort of lunge into the public space with every single piece of information that you hear. But when you establish that there's a pattern, when you see that there's a trend, there are so many elements in this story that are coming together that are shaping the story beyond the attempts by the Pentagon to shape it. I think the Pentagon has lost control of this story.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that they lost control of the burnt Quran story, in the same way, you know, the power of media now, and I'm not trying to make a confused thing here when I talk about the need for editing. Yes, I do. But the impact of media these days forces the hand of officialdom in a way that I don't think it previously did. And here I'm talking about the need for leaders to feel that they have to be in the media space. And I think that if you didn't have that sense on the minds of politicians, you probably wouldn't have had the Western intervention in Libya last year. You had, you know, leaders competing with each other to be on top of what was in the media space, and that required them to actually intervene in Libya rather than their great concern for what was happening on the ground there. So when you have YouTube videos of Marines urinating on the bodies of suspected Taliban fighters, when you you have the sort of constant barrage of information and from so many sources, it's very difficult for the organizations like the Pentagon, who historically did take control and managed much greater and more effective control of the story in the public space.
Oh, we have a few calls on this. Let's hear from Michael in San Francisco. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having your show. I'm not trying to take away from the story that you're currently on, the massacre, at all, but may I bring up a concomitant story?
Yes, please.
Yeah, Jeremy Scahill has done a wonderful job. He's got an article in this month's Nation on President Obama's personal intercession in keeping a reporter, a Yemeni reporter, in jail. He personally made the call to the then dictator of the country, he's no longer in power, to keep this man in jail because he had reported many, many stories on what was really going on with U.S. policy and al-Qaeda, and in particular the Majella massacre in Yemen, where countless women and children only were killed, and the U.S. put out the story, we've taken out a whole nest of al-Qaeda, you know, jihadists or whatever. And he was arrested twice, beaten in jail, kept in jail. He still is in jail. And this is in direct counterpoint to the U.S. policy, and President Obama will jump in, and so will Hillary Clinton. The woman, I'm forgetting her name, the woman's name in Iran, the foreign correspondent who was arrested in the world, the Western world went crazy, and yet here President Obama is keeping somebody in jail because he's telling the truth about U.S. policy and putting the Americans, as well they deserve, in a bad light.
Well, thank you for this. So Jeremy Scahill wrote a piece about this for The Nation. He was on Democracy Now! Yesterday, and this is involving the imprisonment of a Yemeni journalist who exposed how the U.S. was behind a 2009 bombing in Yemen that killed 14 women and 21 children. Paul, have you been following this? Have you heard about this?
No, I'm not on top of that story, but what it does gel with is the darker side, if you like, of this administration, which is that it has been obsessive in its attempts to shut down leaks, to pursue people who leak information to the media, and to make it a major, major sort of undeclared campaign that there will be no leaks, that we will control, that we will attempt to massage and shape what goes into the public space. And this sounds as though it's in keeping with that, albeit on a very nasty scale.
And yes, and we'll put a link to that. Jeremy Scahill said he made a point saying that the local journalists around the world, many of them Arab journalists that no one's ever heard of, they get killed more than anyone else. They get wounded more than anyone else. They get imprisoned by these dictatorships. And without them, if their voices are silenced, we will not get anywhere near the complete picture of what's happening in these war zones. So thank you. That was a very important story this week. And we'll put links at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Kathleen in San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. The speaker just said that the Pentagon has lost control of the story on the massacre, and I'd like to ask him whatever right the Pentagon has to have control of the story.
I didn't assume that it has a right. I wasn't suggesting that it has a right. It has an inclination. It attempts. The nature of institutions is that they attempt to shape everything that emanates from them or around them in the public space. You can debate whether it's a right or not. All I'm saying is that they have lost control.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Kathleen. And Paul, do you think that the coverage this time around about these massacres is different? Because a lot of the questions I'm hearing, I heard in 2009 and 2010, the sort of same questions about what soldiers deal with. And were you familiar with Winter Soldier, when a lot of the soldiers from Iraq came back to testify about what they had done on the ground and what they had seen?
Yes, yes.
And I just wonder, do we ever learn? I mean, what... Back then, the soldiers said, I committed war crimes. This is what happened. We go on night raids. We knock down doors. So is anything here different?
No, it's not. I mean, we've heard that the Americans on the ground in Afghanistan have rewritten the rules for night raids, and that they've attempted to be more circumspect before they launch aerial bombardments to make sure that the target is the target. And I have to say on that I have been in command and control bunkers in Afghanistan and watched them attempt to live by those rules. And I've seen them not drop a bomb where they thought some Taliban fighters were hiding in a small building on a hill, because their view was there were buildings nearby that there could be people in. So there is an attempt in the sort of the ebb and flow or the cut and thrust of war. There is an attempt to reduce problem areas. I suppose that's the way you'd put it. You don't get the sense that it's driven by a concern for mankind so much as an understanding that mankind will complain, whether it's a Karzai or whether it's the Afghan people, if it's not done with greater sensitivity or with greater control of the operation. So if there's a problem, they'll rewrite the rules to try and make it less of a problem. But you still get problems. I mean, John Lee Anderson wrote a piece on the New Yorker website this week saying that all of these stories that we're hearing in Afghanistan, he's making your point, we heard them all in different ways in Iraq.
Right.
And every war, I suppose it's the nature of war. And, you know, war makes people do ugly, terrible things. And that's why war is such an admission of failure, because it brings us back to that incredibly base element of humankind.
We were actually going to point out this piece in The New Yorker by John Lee Anderson. He writes, "This is merely the latest in a string of episodes in which American soldiers, in spite of the positive intentions of an overwhelming majority of the troops there, have shown scorn, disrespect, and increasingly and tragically hatred for the people of the country hosting them." And we'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. We've got a number of emails about this also. I'll just read one right before we go to break. Matt in Millbrae says, "If past history is any guide, it is highly unlikely that there will be any serious consequences for the American sergeant who executed children at point-blank range. The recent extremely light sentences from the trials of various soldiers charged with the murder of civilians in Haditha, Iraq, is a most worrisome precedent here." Thank you for the email, and you can email us. But better yet, I'd love it if you can post your comments at yourcallradio.org so others can read them. You don't have to have an account or anything. You just type in your name and put in your comment there. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
Every week, 10,000 plus listeners all over the Bay Area. Tune into KLW, not at 91.7 FM, but via our online streams at klw.org. So if you travel outside the Bay Area or sometimes encounter the limits of our signal, the online stream is a great way to stay connected. And if you have a smartphone, you can listen on your iPhone, Android, or BlackBerry. Just click the Listen Live link at the top of klw.org, and you'll see all the options.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we'll have a conversation about water conservation in California. What water issues are we facing? We're finally getting a little bit of rain, but we're still less than half the historical average. So how should we conserve and how safe is our water? That's on Monday. Tuesday, we'll be talking about gas prices and going beyond the headlines and the rhetoric we're hearing from the presidential candidates. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the recent massacre in Afghanistan. On Sunday morning, an unnamed American soldier in Kandahar left his base, entered the homes of three families, and allegedly murdered 16 Afghans, including 9 children. All of the information we're getting thus far is directly from the military. They're saying that he's a 38-year-old soldier. He's serving his 4th term, 3 in Iraq, this time in Afghanistan. He's reportedly en route to a detention facility in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The soldier's family has hired John Henry Brown to represent him. This is the same lawyer who represented serial killer Ted Bundy. So what did you make of the coverage of this latest atrocity? Are you seeing any reports that are connecting the dots between this one and past atrocities? And what questions should reporters be asking at this point? We've got full lines right now, but we'll have a few lines open in a couple minutes. 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org so others can see it. Today we're joined by Paul McGough, chief foreign correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald, author of Infernal Triangle, Conflict in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Levant, Eyewitness Accounts from the September 11th Decade. Paul has reported from the Middle East for more than 2 decades. And now I'd like to welcome Anna Botkin. Anna is an independent journalist and author of Piecemeals, Waiting for the Taliban, and the forthcoming e-book, Afghanistan by Donkey. And Anna has spent many years reporting from inside Afghanistan, and most of her reports focus on what the people are actually going through. Hi, Anna. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, Rose. Hello, Paul. Thank you for having me again.
Well, thank you for joining us. We just spent the first 30 minutes really talking about what this coverage looks like and how, you know, so many of the questions reporters are asking sound like the same questions they asked in past atrocities, whether it was in Iraq or Afghanistan. What strikes you about the coverage this time around, Anna, and has anything different standing out this time?
You know, what strikes me about the coverage this time is that there is very little that's different. So we're surprised, shocked, appalled. We're waiting for, you know, the proverbial Afghan reaction. Today is Friday, so what's going to happen after the prayers? Why aren't Afghans more upset about this massacre than they were about the Quran burnings, blah, blah, blah? What the conversation I'm not hearing, and that's the conversation I think we should be having and we should have been having all along for the last decade, is what? Why are we imposing our view of the world, our view of reactions to atrocities on a society that may be different than ours? Why are we surprised that Afghans are not reacting to the massacre with the same vehemence as they did to the Quran burnings? These are the conversations I think are important to have because they could be an opener into a deeper conversation of what are we trying to achieve.
So how would you go about reporting that story? You know, if the New York Times said, Anna Botkin, you've been in the villages, you know what it's like on the ground. What kind of story would you want to write?
I would want to talk about the cumulative grief. I would want to remind my audience that for an Afghan, though, of course, let's start with me saying that I would not in any way discount the murder of 16 people as unimportant or not extraordinary or not absolutely heartrending and devastating. But the people of Afghanistan, with whom I spent a lot of time living, have a very different view of this war from the view we have here in the United States. To us, this is the longest U.S. overseas engagement. To us, this is a decade-long war, you know, now longer than a decade. To us, this is a war that has claimed 1,000-plus American lives, you know, from 7 to 30,000 Afghan lives. From the point of view of Afghans, this is just the most recent iteration of conflict in which they have lived continuously. So, you know, I've had conversations in villages where I've asked, say, a high school Pashto language teacher, which, you know, what is the main difference that you've seen in your students recently? And the teacher would think and say, well, they stopped carrying weapons to school because the Taliban prohibited them. So that's, you know, his main event happened before the U.S. occupation, before even, you know, 15 years ago, almost 18 years ago. Time is looked at differently, and tragedies such as the one we saw this week are looked at differently because the context is different. So I would be trying to put this atrocity less in the context of us, Americans, looking at it from the United States, and more in the context of Afghans looking at it from their villages, from inside their society, from inside their family. Because what we might see then might be very surprising and very educating.
And Paul, we briefly touched on this earlier, but what about you? What angle would you take?
Well, I think you need to do both. You have to use the sensitivities on both sides to explore the differences and to learn to understand them. What Anna says about time in particular is incredibly important. The whole way through this conflict, the notion, the Afghan and the Taliban notion of time is completely at odds with the Western sense. And while there isn't the clock running for the Afghans as we understand it, the clock has been running for the West since day one in Afghanistan. And that is the essential flaw in this entire adventure, is that from day one, the West has been attempting to go out the door backwards. On the other side, to a certain extent, what you've had is Karzai and the rest of the kleptocracy, for want of a better word, wanting to keep the West in Afghanistan for as long as possible because they are bleeding the Western treasuries of significant amounts of cash. Mm. So you've got that dynamic on both sides that needs to be explored and needs to be understood. One of the best comments, one of the most sage comments on this whole conflict came shortly after the so-called McChrystal report, when he came up with his blueprint for how you quote win the war, and that was one of the American generals who confided to a reporter that we've been fighting the same war every year. Mm. The West, the coalition, was not learning. It was not learning about Afghan culture. It was not learning about Afghanistan geography. It was not learning about the Afghan people and how they live and their senses and sensibilities in terms of how to become engaged with them, to give them something that might be lasting and might be useful for them in their society, something that they would shape as opposed to something that the West would bring in this box that it calls democracy. Hey, we've got this gift called democracy for you. You've got to take it. Doesn't work. It never works.
Well, and what about that just basic question? NPR's recent headline, Killing a Blow to U.S. Strategy in Afghanistan. Anna, what is this strategy? I mean, the U.S. is spending $115 billion a year. It has the most powerful, most technologically advanced military in the world. And Afghanistan is a country comprised of, well, over half the population is living in poverty. So what is the strategy?
Yes. So since we're in the news hour here and quoting writing by colleagues, I'm going to quote something that I read yesterday. Instead of an encounter with the other in which we proposed certain ideas, proposal based on assumptions of equality, respectfully tendered, our encounters were distinguished by a stern, relentless imposition of ideas, religious, economic, and social ideas, we deemed superior, if not unimpeachable. This is Barry Lopez, a writer who lives in Oregon, writing about the invasion of North America. What the reason I'm bringing this up, and I'm segueing from what Paul has said, we're not listening. We have, exactly as Paul has beautifully put it, we have a boxed idea of democracy. We are not listening to what people in Afghanistan want and need. And I'm not talking about the kleptocracy in Kabul. We know what they want. They want the millions, the billions. I'm talking about 80% of the population who live very, very rurally, who don't care about democracy because they're losing 5, 6, 10, 20 children a year, a winter, to the cold per village, and 10, 15, 20 children per year, per summer, to dysentery per village. You know, we were, the news of children dying of cold in Kabul in the refugee camps was all over the news this winter. It was a very, very cold winter in Kabul, and kids who were living in refugees and in refugee camps in abysmal conditions were dying of the cold. That's the story of every winter in Afghanistan. Go to any village and you will go to the cemetery and you will see that the freshest graves in the winter are the smallest ones because children are dying because there is no health care. Children are dying because their mothers are uneducated about health care, not about, you know, algebra. Forget algebra. Forget the idea of high schools for girls, because girls who attend high schools will then go home. They will not participate in the economy of the country the way women in the West participate in the economy of the country. That's simply not how the country is built. Women will participate in the economy of the home, so they need to know how to make sure the children are healthy, how to recognize a common cold, how to recognize the flu, what to do in case of the flu. Why are we focusing on these beautiful and absolutely, for the most part, inapplicable ideas of building, you know, making sure all women have high school education or, rebuilding universities, when we're not focusing on the basics, you know, bringing maybe mobile clinics to villages to make sure people aren't sick, maybe distributing blankets, maybe teaching people how to share even provincially their goods. You know, there's a village that's very remote that makes wool. There is a village that produces wool. But there is a village very remote that can weave that wool, but they will never connect because there is no road between the two. So we're focusing on this very global picture of Afghanistan. I think what we need to be doing is focusing on very local picture of Afghanistan.
One of the absurdities that emerged this week on the whole Afghanistan adventure was this. We talk and we speculate about how much international aid money is going into the Afghan economy, and the figure that I saw this week was $15 billion. And the piece that I was reading then segued immediately to the fact that of that, or presumably of that, about $4 billion a year in cash is monitored as it goes through Kabul International Airport, leaving the country. Now, we've been reading about that figure, that proportion of the aid that is being spirited out of the country on an annual basis, and nobody seems to have said, we've got to stop that.
Mm.
We've either got to reduce the money that we're putting in there if that's what's happening, or we've got to find a way for, and by we, I'm not just talking about the West, I'm talking about the whole combine. But the absurdity of pouring money in there so that it can be taken out by the suitcase load is patently absurd. The other thing, Anna has touched on it, is, you know, the whole thing about education in Afghanistan, where, you know, we see the pictures of children going to school, and they're wonderful pictures, and they're huge in their PR impact. But every time I see one of those pictures, I get sick in the stomach, because the first thought that I have is, what are we educating these children for? This is a country that, apart from drugs, effectively doesn't have an economy other than its local village-based economies. So we're going to put them through primary school. They might end up doing a bit of secondary school. And then what? We've taken them to a point where they will be capable of thinking through what they don't have against what they were promised. And my bet and my anxiety is, at some stage in the future, from time to time, they will get incredibly angry about that. And what will they do with that anger?
That is Paul McGow. He's chief foreign correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald. We're also joined by independent journalist Anna Bodkin. They have both reported extensively from Afghanistan. Let's go through a few callers, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Luzia in Felton. Hi, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I think what has struck me most about this latest incident is how it represents the moral and psychological and spiritual deterioration of our military, and how that once again this soldier is being made an example, and nobody is actually questioning the command. Nobody is actually questioning who is sending these young men back into duty. And as somebody said, that people aren't being listened to. These soldiers themselves aren't being listened to. They're not being credited with some even knowledge of their own emotional state. Instead, they're being treated, right, as their own actual victims of this establishment. And so I think what's very difficult for me is that once again, these young men are being made examples of, and nobody's questioning the command.
Well, thank you. We're actually going to have a few journalists on next Friday to talk about those very issues about the soldier. So thanks for calling in, Luzia. Let's go next to Susie in San Francisco. Hi, Susie.
Hi. I was chilled by a comment of Leon Panetta, Secretary of Defense, when he evaluated the situation of the killings as being horrific, but he said, war is horrific. Mm. War is horrific, and there will be incidents. There were incidents like this in the past, and there will be incidents like this again.
Right. He did say that. Well, and we hear that often from politicians. War is horrific. War is hell. Thank you. We'll get a comment in a minute. Let's hear from Neil in San Francisco. Hi, Neil.
Is this me?
Yes.
It's in Berkeley, actually. Hi, Rose.
Oh, hi. Sorry about that.
I'm a little off topic. I wanted to mention a film that I saw this week that's fascinating. It's called Love Crimes of Kabul. And it's made by an Iranian-born but American-raised filmmaker named Tanaz Ishagian. And it was made for HBO, and I saw it at the Pacific Film Archive, and I don't know if it'll be showing locally again, but she got access to this women's prison in Kabul where a number of, I think half the women are being held for what they call moral crimes, mainly either running away from home or having sex before marriage. And she profiles three of them, and it totally confounded my expectations or understandings about Afghan society on a number of levels. First, the women were very, very forthright, bold, unapologetic, and fairly well-educated, I thought. And on the second level, the justice system, from our point of view, would be pretty cruel in terms of classifying these women's transgressions as crimes, and they were facing serious punishment, many years in some cases. But the people who administered the justice system, from the female wardens in the prison to the male judiciary members, all were compassionate and believed that their justice system was what held society together and was, just. Mm. And they treated these women fairly, although the punishment could be very harsh. So it totally blew me away in terms of my understanding of Afghan society.
Hmm. Well, thank you. We'll put a link to the website, and hopefully it'll be available for us to see it. Thank you for that. Let's hear... I think we're done with callers. We've got a number of emails. But before that, you know, speaking of women, Anna, I wanted to ask you a question about an AP article that came out a couple weeks ago called Hamid Karzai Backs Restrictive Code for Women. Do you know anything about this? He's backing this Ulema Council document, which allows husbands to beat wives and encourages segregation of the sexes. And he's doing this, according to this piece, to reach out to the Taliban.
Well, of course, he was doing this at the time of talks, before the Taliban once again canceled the talks, right? So he was trying to, he is a politician, he's trying to appease the Taliban, who are in the position of strength, and he knows that he is not. So, it's not surprising. And also, Karzai, I don't know if our audience remembers, but a couple of years ago, he backed a law, and he later was forced to back off of that basically legalized rape in Shia communities, spousal mm-hmm. rape. Then last year he tried to, there was a draft that was, did not pass and become a law that would have put all shelters for abused women under government, the auspices of the government, and women would have to undergo very, very brutal exams, including gynecological exams, to show that they indeed had been violated or, you know, had reason to run away from home, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I think it's politicking. Ultimately, what is very important to understand, whatever happens in Kabul, you know, stays in Karzai's palace. Basically, it doesn't really reverberate through the society. The society is very conservative. Beatings at home happen regardless of what the government says. Rapes happen regardless of what the government says. Even if Karzai passed suddenly the most liberal law that would grant women extraordinarily unheard of rights, that wouldn't make any difference.
And just quickly, because the media are focusing on the latest comments from Hamid Karzai coming out today, slamming the U.S. over this massacre, but he slams the U.S. every time there's a massacre and nothing seems to change. So do you think this is going to change the relationship at all between the two, Anna?
I think that the relationship between the two is very fragile. I think at the same time, I think Karzai realizes that the United States does not see an alternative to him, and therefore will try to keep him in power at all costs, which may be one of the tragedies of Afghanistan right now.
And Paul, you wanted to jump in?
I was just going to make the point that I did a story, I think it was about 3 years ago now, on a village couple in the far north of the country who very courageously went to the courts and pursued right to up to conviction three local warlords, commanders, after the wife of this couple was raped in the strange street of the village and dragged naked through the village. They were finally jailed, and literally within months of them being jailed on the rape charges, they were freed from prison on the signature of Hamid Karzai.
Mm. Well, I want to read just a couple comments from our website, and then we'll get you both to respond. We have just a couple minutes left. IK writes, why is the military cover-up of this incident not a story in itself? From the basic facts in the first AP stories written on the massacre, it was clear the assessment was untruthful. Why is there no critique of the military or the administration when it comes to such incidents? This may be part of the reason these wars continue. No one is made to be accountable. And actually, our producer, Malihe Razazan, was reading the Afghan papers, and a lot of the Afghans say that more than one soldier was involved. They were coming to the homes to actually rape the women, and the men were standing up for them. Again, there's no way to confirm any of this because all of the information comes directly from the military. So how do you confirm these claims, Anna?
It's a good question. And it is, I think your first caller raised a similar question.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I want to read a couple more comments. People keep saying the Afghans on the ground report that as many as 20 soldiers were involved. What is being lost is the disgusting regularity of these events. American troops are being driven insane as a matter of policy of the Department of Defense. So we're going to talk about more in depth about soldiers next week. But, Paul, where does this story go from here?
What happens often with a story like this is if you're to say to anyone now, what happened with the story of the urinating on the bodies? It gets factored into the narrative. It becomes a ballast point, if you like, to the advantage of one or other, another side in the story. What happened with the Quran burning? What's happening with these stories on a regular basis in Afghanistan is they are making the American presence in Afghanistan in the minds of the majority of the people of Afghanistan, as opposed to the government of Afghanistan, increasingly untenable. You know, the notion that you can have these three things, in, you know, they're coming at the rate of one a month at the moment.
Right.
The notion that you could sustain that through to the end of 2014 just beggars belief to me.
Mm. Well, unfortunately...
Well, another question. What happens... Do we know all of them? Do they happen with an even higher regularity, and we simply right. don't know about them because somehow the news doesn't get out?
Yeah, I mean, that's another important question, and unfortunately we're out of time. We have a lot of emails about what really goes on at these bases, and we'll talk about that next week. Anna Bodkin is an independent journalist. Her forthcoming ebook is Afghanistan by Donkey. Paul McGough is chief foreign correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald. His latest book is Infernal Triangle. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What's in store for the future of water conservation in California? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about water issues facing the state. The recent rain has brought the total rainfall for the year to 4.64 inches. This is less than half the historical average. So what should we do to conserve water, and what are some of the biggest issues we're facing? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. How should we conserve water, and how safe is our water? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
I'm Jesse Thorne, and there's some stuff that if you don't know about it, you really should.
My friend, we are going to be talking about Lucha Libre, a.k.a. Mexican wrestling, a.k.a. awesomeness. They really stay in character. The most legendary wrestler of all time, El Santo, there's reportedly only one photograph of him in existence without the mask on.
Josh Clark and Chuck Bryan from the podcast Stuff You Should Know on Bullseye from PRI.
This is KALW San Francisco. Hello, I'm Philippa Thomas. Welcome to the BBC's World Have Your Say. We're talking about the US soldier accused of shooting 16 in Afghanistan.
We have a soldier who has an exemplary record, a decorated soldier who was injured in Iraq to his brain and to his body, and then despite that was sent back. I think that's an issue.
We'll be asking, what do we know about what made him snap? We'll be talking to other soldiers about the stress of service. And Lynn from Texas emailed us to say they're looking over their shoulder constantly to see if the Afghan they're training is going to turn his gun on them. And we'll talk about today's announcement from the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, standing down after 10 years as head of the Anglican Church. Desmond Tutu tells us exclusively that his profound spirituality and prayerfulness and massive intellect helped to hold the church together. What do you think?